attacking Iran, decapitating Venezuela, threatening Cuba. What is really going on inside the room where it happens? Donald Trump's Deputy Secretary of State in his first administration and the chief negotiator with North Korea, Stephen Biegun, was in the room where it happens. Stephen takes us inside the president's inner circle and the Trump you don't see behind the scenes. What are the vulnerabilities and liabilities that you would have known in advance could emerge from having President Trump in power, surrounded by people who were there because of loyalty tests instead of competence?
You can work in that world. You can bring a discipline, a patriotism. You know,
of course you can, but the current people aren't. And so I'm just interested.
Some people are.
G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Here's a dangerous question we are all asking ourselves. What the hell is going on with Donald Trump's foreign policy? Is this America flexing its muscles or flailing around on the world stage? Is there a method to the madness? What is really going on inside the room where it happens? Today's guest knows. He has been there. Stephen Biegun was the Deputy Secretary of State in Donald Trump's first term, and he was in charge of North Korea policy specifically. He was brought into the room by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, to try to pull off a really world-first historical event, an actual in-person meeting between the President of the United States and the Supreme Leader of North Korea. The pair had just met for the first time, and the Secretary of State felt that someone with Biegun's expertise was required to try to shepherd American foreign policy through this completely new terrain. We hear a lot about the adults who are in the room in the first Trump administration who may or may not be absent in the second Trump administration. And while Donald Trump was tweeting about Rocket Man and about how his missiles are bigger than little Rocket Man's missiles, it was Stephen Biegun who was trying to take that and, like an alchemist, turn it into a world historical opportunity. So what was it like to work with Donald Trump on complex foreign policy negotiations? What happened on Biegun and Trump's last-minute sorties into the DMZ between the Supreme Leader and the Leader of the Free World? And what has Stephen's experience in seeing Donald Trump's worldview up close and in person taught him about how America should be dealing with Putin, with Ukraine, and with Iran? Biegun was no novice to government. He actually served under Condoleezza Rice in the George W. Bush administration on the National Security Council. He's also a business person. He was a senior executive at Ford, the motor company. And he was kind enough to join us while he was in Sydney delivering a major lecture to the Lowy Institute, which kindly facilitated this conversation about American power, diplomacy, the limits of war, and the Trump you don't see behind the scenes. I hope you enjoy as much as I did. The one, the only, Stephen Biegun. I'm fascinated initially by the simple, cool logistics of going to the DMZ and meeting the North Korean leader, right? Like, so this was the final meeting that the Trump administration had with the Supreme Leader of North Korea, yeah, right, in 2019. And I remember, I think it was the first time that I saw your name, where I was reading something about this, and I was like, how do I even do it where they're at the DMZ? Like, what is it? Talk me through it. What does it look like?
You want the short version or the long version?
Either one.
All right, well, you
cut me off. I'll interrupt you when it gets boring.
Okay. So, you are correct. This was the last leader-level meeting between the United States and North Korea. We had subsequent meetings, but this was the last leader-level meeting. And it was the third of three meetings that President Trump had with Kim Jong-un. The first was the Singapore summit in 2018. The second was the Hanoi summit in late February of 2019, which didn't reach an agreement, I would say. I wouldn't call it a failure, though.
People called it a failure, but right. I've heard you say, well, we just didn't get an agreement. What's the difference between a failure and
but it also wasn't, it demonstrably wasn't the end of the diplomacy, because they met again in the DMZ at the end of June the same year.
So, but how do you know whether they're just meeting to kick the can down the road and keep humoring you while they do whatever they want?
Well, I think, frankly, if they were not interested in a meeting, they just wouldn't meet. It's not their style to kind of play you or kick the can down the road.
Right. They don't have any incentive.
Yeah. In fact, you know, one of their tactics they use is part of their negotiating strategy is just rationing contact. So you can go weeks, even months, without the North Koreans responding to a single message. And in fact, in June of 2019, which is the period we're talking about here on the DMZ, The North Koreans had not responded to a single message from the United States of America since the end of the Hanoi summit.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they ration this contact. They want a concession just to talk.
Right.
And we just drew a hard line at that. Talking was not a reward. We didn't reward talking.
Yeah,
we rewarded action. And so,
and just to clarify, when you say you know all of the contacts that you make go rebuffed, mm-hmm. what is the normal mechanism by which governments send an email to each other? Is Mike Pompeo sending a letter, like a stamped letter to Pyongyang, or
so,
what?
So this happens? has been the dilemma, the impossible situation that previous governments have found themselves in, because you can send a letter and they send it back. I mean, you can try to slip it under their door and they literally kick it right back out underneath the door.
Unopened.
Yeah.
Right. If they don't
want to communicate.
Right.
You can try.
It's like trying to deal with a cat or something. Trying to tease it into taking its medicine.
It is, but it is a tactic. There was an ASEAN summit after the Singapore summit where,
for our American listeners, that's a club of Southeast Asian nations, ASEAN.
Sorry, yeah. I should be more specific.
That's right.
There's the North Korean minister was there, and Secretary Pompeo, who I worked for, wanted to have an exchange with him, wanted to hand him actually a letter. And he literally chased him around the room. The man was running around the room trying to keep the table between him and Pompeo because he didn't want to take the letter.
Right.
And then he finally took it. He got cornered and he took the letter.
Right. It's me with my 8-year-old son trying to get him to put his socks on.
Yeah,
and he's on the other side of the couch.
Yeah, exactly. But eventually you get him. And we did. How do you normally talk to the North Koreans? You do it through letters. You do it through, there's no phone. It's not, they have cell phones. They're diplomats in the United States, and we had those numbers, but they wouldn't answer.
Amazing.
One time, one of the diplomats, when they were under a period of instruction not to talk to us, accidentally answered his phone. and we were considering the possibility he'd be executed. And I'm not joking.
Wow.
It's that severe. So,
it's like getting a call from someone who's trying to sell you something. You accidentally pick it up and they're like, I'd like to talk to you about your energy bills. They're like, oh shit, no, it's the Americans. Hang up.
Yeah. You know, communicating with them was like serving legal papers.
Yeah, right. Right.
But they're dodging it, but if you can get it in their hands.
And the president of the United States doesn't have a secure phone hookup to
nothing.
The Supreme Leader's
nothing
office.
There's no line that goes through. But this is the dilemma that previous administrations had in the era of Donald Trump. That was conquered.
Yeah.
Through Twitter. Twitter
right.
became
right.
the broadcast that the president could deliver messages to the North Koreans, and they heard every single one of them. They pored over them. They analyzed them. They studied them. And very often they responded to them, Josh.
Little Kim and his rockets, little rocket man.
On one hand. And on the other hand, love letters, as President Trump would call them.
Yeah.
One Christmas Eve, literally Christmas Eve, I'm in the Oval Office with the president, and he's penning a year-end note to Kim Jong-un, debating this word or that word. And he decides on a lark to also have a photo taken by the White House photographer, and he posts it on his Twitter feed. And the North Koreans hadn't spoken to us at that point in maybe 6 or 8 weeks. This was in December of 2018, and within 24 hours, they were reaching out to us. So it worked, and that's, by the way, how that meeting at the DMZ in 2019 happened. So I'm sitting in my hotel room early on a Saturday morning, sleeping in my hotel room.
In
early,
Pyongyang?
In Seoul.
Oh, okay. Right.
I've arrived in Seoul.
Oh, you're coming from the south, obviously.
Well, I've arrived in Seoul from the United States because President Trump is expected later that day, coming in from Japan, where he was at a G20 summit, the Group of 20 Nations. He's flying into Seoul for a state visit. So I fly ahead of time because North Korea is on the agenda. I don't need to be with him in Japan. I'm in South Korea. And there's a pounding on my door at 6 a.m. It's one of my aides. And he says, Secretary of State on the phone needs to talk to you immediately. So I get up. I call on my mobile. I kept my mobile off because I just traveled to Asia. I didn't want anybody waking me up in the middle of the night to ask me if I wanted to have lunch tomorrow. It's Pompeo, Secretary Pompeo on the phone. And he says that he had a chat with the president the night before in the limousine on the way home from the state leaders' dinner. And the president said, we're going to be in South Korea. North Korea is just like very close. Why don't we reach out to Kim Jong-un and see if he wants to get together when I'm there? He's, mind you, he's not even going to be in South Korea for more than 36 hours.
Right.
And so they're in Japan. Pompeo says, let's sleep on it. I'll talk to Steve. And in the morning, you know, we'll make a decision. The president says, fine. So Pompeo calls me to say, you know, what do you think? And, you know, he and I looked at him like, they're not even talking to us. Like, how would we even reach them? How could we in such a short amount of time prepare this meeting? It's not. And what if they say no? What if they rebuff the president? Does that make him look weak? Does that make us look weak? So we're like, yeah, bad idea. So he says, okay, I'll go tell the president. So I, you know, I'm out of bed now. So I get the coffee maker going, making my first cup of coffee, and I flip on the television, flip on CNN to see what happened overnight. And it wasn't a moment later that scrolling across the bottom is the text of a tweet from President Trump to Kim Jong-un saying, hey, Chairman Kim, I'm going to be in South Korea. Would love to meet. And I'm just like, crap.
So like, much for me being in charge of North Korea policy in this administration. But
that's living in the Trump world, Josh. So there it is on the TV. And I'm like, okay, but they're still not talking to us. How do we even do it? And so my aide who knocked on the door, he was a great, great young diplomat, Korean speaker. I asked him to monitor the Korean newswire, see if they said anything publicly. And sure enough, about 2-3 hours later, a message came out, said, we are intrigued by the message from President Trump, but don't understand what his intentions are. And I heard that construct, and I was like, oh, crap, this is going to happen.
That's a yes.
That's not a no, because when they say no, they say it like they mean it, and you can understand it. So there we are. It was off to the races. Through the guard posts at either end of the DMZ on the most fortified border in the world, there's a hotline that in normal times is supposed to be checked once or twice a day. You know, just make sure the technology is working. But again, the North Koreans will go months without even answering it, even though that's the agreement, that's the protocol.
This is a hotline from one side of the DMZ
from
to the
South
other
Korea
side
to North Korea.
Yeah, the other side of the DMZ, not all the way to the capital city.
DMZ guard post, DMZ guard post. They can see each other.
Got it.
And so we call up to we call the U.S. commander. We say, look, can you have the guard post do a hotline call and ask them if they want to meet? And so they call. That phone rings, nobody answers it. And so the protocol that we'd been using in the U.S. when we really had to pass an important message to the North Koreans, usually about local security issues, some sort of incident, our U.S. soldiers would go down to the line of demarcation, like right to the border. And they would wait for a North Korean to come down and stand across, and then they would read them a message. And the North Koreans would hold a video camera and tape the message, and that was it. That was the exchange. They wouldn't say anything. They just record it. Actually, up until about 6 months before that, the U.S. soldier would come down there with a bullhorn, and they would stand there with a North Korean about 2 feet from them speaking through the bullhorn, because that was what they were instructed to do. And the U.S. commander said, guys, use a little bit of sense here. Standing right there,
we can lose the bullhorn.
Yep, we can lose the bullhorn. So they did that. 2 hours later, the hotline rings from the North Korean side to our side saying, we'd like to do a meeting 7 p.m. tonight, DMZ, North Korean side. I'm sitting down in Seoul, which is an hour drive from the border, wrapping up a few things. And I've got to hustle to get up to the DMZ. So flew up on a helicopter with my team. The U.S. commanding general provided just full support for us there. We flew up and I got out of the helicopter at the DMZ and stepped out into a minivan driven by a U.S. soldier and with a colonel, U.S. colonel, as an escort in the front seat. And you kind of, you pull away from the helicopter pad, you go up to the row of buildings that, you know, many have seen, that kind of row of blue buildings that are the historic properties of Panmunjom Village, of the demilitarized zone. You go to the end of the buildings and then you go left and you drive into the woods because there's no road. There's no road between the two sides because the whole point is to keep each other out of each other's countries. And so, and by the way, this whole band between those two borders is mined with minefields. But there's an agreed understanding of a route that's kept open. So you kind of go to the third oak tree on the left, then you turn left and you go into the little clearing in the woods, and then you veer a little bit to the right. And then all of a sudden you pop out and you're in North Korea on the road.
Wow.
So there is a path. We drove another minute or so, got to a building, and for the next 3 hours sat with a group of North Koreans that was waiting for us there to work out the details of a meeting that happened the next day at 1 p.m. So, you know, less than 36 hours after the president tweets this on television, or tweets us publicly from Japan, he's in South Korea on Sunday, just afternoon, meeting face-to-face with Kim Jong-un.
And how does he get there? Same way? How does the president get there?
Well, he flies on Air Force One, and then a helicopter package flies him up to the DMZ.
Yeah, right. He flies into Seoul.
He flies into Seoul.
Yeah, yeah.
He flies into Osan, which is the Air Force base there.
And does he have to do the whole third oak tree on the right?
No.
Driving across, he can fly into North Korea.
So in this case, they did the meeting on the South Korean side.
Oh, I see.
That was the negotiation. Okay. But Kim Jong-un came out of a building on his side, and there's an open space in the middle. Many people have seen this on television. You know, there's literally a line that separates one half of the compound from the other half of the compound, from South Korea from North Korea. Kim Jong-un comes down the stairs and walks to the line. And very dramatically, President Trump walks up to the line on the other side, and they shake hands across the line. Mm. And then President Trump says something, and the next thing you know, he's walking into North Korea. So he asked Kim Jong-un, he said, look, I'd love to be the first U.S. president to visit North Korea. So he starts walking, and he's walking, Josh, and he keeps walking. I'm like,
how is this?
I'm like, he going to stop?
Exactly. What is the Secret Service thinking? Like, I'm just thinking about the security logistics of this. I mean, on a practical level, like that you're in the van going to the third oak tree. How can you be certain that the North Koreans aren't going to mistake the van for something else and they're going to blow you up? How can you be certain that they're not going to kidnap the president of the United States? Like, it seems all very, it seems like winging it in a.
Well, I suppose you could let your imagination run wild on these things. But we are the United States of America, Josh. I mean, first of all, there's not going to be a lot achieved from doing something to me or kidnapping me. It's not going to move the needle. But yeah, President of the United States in theory, yes. But you know, truth is, nobody's going to do that.
Yeah, right.
That's not even a bet. That's just reality.
Yeah, right.
And
as long as he stays close to the supreme leader, they're not going to step on a landmine because if they had
a mischief in mind, they would have never showed up.
Yeah.
Anyway, but no, that wasn't even a consideration, okay, honestly.
That's fascinating. And then in terms of the content of the negotiations, I've heard you talk about like how during the Singapore talks, like it did seem like there could be some movement and that that Kim Jong-un was coming up with ideas about how they could sign something on a U.S. aircraft carrier or like...
Yeah, so you're conflating a few things, but the short answer is yeah, it seemed like there was potential. In the meetings, in the one-on-one meetings between the president and Kim Jong-un, oftentimes they would together explore kind of the maximum extent where they thought we could get in negotiations and diplomacy. On paper out of Singapore, there wasn't much detail, candidly, and I had very little to work with coming out of that summit. But when you watch the interactions between the two, now it's possible. It's possible for sure. With analytical rigor, you have to allow for the possibility Kim Jong-un was just playing the president, trying to buy some time. But again, it would be contrary to their normal approach, because if that was the case, they just wouldn't meet.
Right.
It's possible also that Kim Jong-un really wanted to go someplace with the United States of America, with the president in these negotiations. But he was constrained by his own system. And, you know, I'd test this theory with South Koreans and they just roll their eyes and tell me, I couldn't be more wrong, you know, because he is a totalitarian dictator. And their thought that there's any sort of collective governance or any sort of, you know, internal pressure or constraint on what Kim Jong-un could or could not do, they just find ludicrous.
Right.
But I got to tell you, in my experience across 40 years in U.S. foreign policy, I find that even dictators kind of have to have a sense of the room around them. And that may not be a constraint in that it's a constitutional restriction on their power or somebody telling them to their face to disagree. But a dictator has a finely tuned ear when he's presenting ideas to his audience on, you know, are they looking down at the table or are they looking him in the eye? Are they applauding just a little with a little less vigor than they might otherwise? You know, these are your feedback mechanisms in a dictatorship. Mm. And Kim Jong-un very well may have been prepared to agree with things the United States of America. but they weren't going to fly in the system. And that's a really important thing to understand when you're negotiating with the North Koreans generally, whether it's with Kim Jong-un or the people he assigned to negotiate with me, is you're not negotiating with that person. You're negotiating with the system. There's so much more that's outside the room that you're trying to negotiate with. And I'm not just speaking figuratively. I'm talking literally. I was negotiating with the North Koreans on the 38th floor of the Koryo Hotel in Pyongyang in January of 2018. And about, you know, every so often we'd run into some area of disagreement, or they'd say, you know, we didn't say that. And I'd say, yes, you did say that. Or, you know, this is what our two leaders agreed to. And they'd say, no, they didn't. And, you know, you'd get into these, like any negotiation. I mean, it wasn't like quibbling, but I'm making it simple for you and for the listeners, but you'd run into an area of disagreement and you'd be sitting there. All of a sudden a guy would walk into the room behind you, you know, come in through the door. And he'd have a little folder like your restaurant bill would be in when you're finishing your meal, and he'd open it up, and their head negotiator would take it out, and he'd read the note, and he'd put it down, and then you'd go a little bit further, and then you'd see what the note said. He'd either say, you know, okay, never mind, we're not going to push that any further, or we agree with you, we'll give you that, or sometimes they would say, we need to take a break. And all that is because somebody's listening into the room the entire time and stage managing and sending direction into the negotiation. You're not negotiating. I'm not negotiating with that guy across the table from me. There's somebody listening in. There's maybe a group of people listening in. And so when they'd say, it's time to take a break, you know, it's not like, okay, everybody get a cup of coffee, go to the bathroom, let's be back here in 10 minutes and we'll get going. It's like, we'll call you.
and you're like, I don't think you will.
So we go back to our hold area and it could be 10 minutes. It could be 2 hours. And we get a call. Okay, we're ready to start again. So, and if sometimes they'd come back and they'd look like the weight of the world had been lifted off their shoulders. Like, oh, you know, finally, we don't have to sell that line that we've been trying to sell to you guys and you're not buying. You could see the relief. Sometimes they'd come back, hair frazzled, eyes wide, like they'd been screamed at for 2 hours. And then, you know, because they somehow fumbled defense at some point or whatever.
Right, right.
You're not negotiating with the person, you're negotiating with the system. And I think that may even be the case with Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, fascinating. Fascinating. Are Western leaders constrained in similar ways?
You know, in different ways. They, you know, all leaders constrained in democracies by public opinion, by, you know, by the support of their constituencies, et cetera. That's there, but not in the same way in North Korea.
Yeah,
so
right.
Our strength, our strength in these negotiations was our ability to be agile. I could sit down with my counterpart. I have a pretty good sense of the parameters of my instructions or what the president wants. And so I could test different ideas. I could try different things, see if they work, you know, break things down, combine them differently, sequence them differently. You know, that kind of agility is our strength. And if I got a deal or got a provisional deal, I could go back and I could pitch it to the president, try to sell it. That's not how the North Korean system works. They get rigid instructions. They're not allowed to deviate an iota from it. It makes it very frustrating at the negotiating table because there's no, well, let's test this idea.
Right.
There's no testing ideas. They've got their instructions, and their job there is simply to recite the negotiating positions, not to negotiate or find middle ground or what have you.
Right. It's actually not a negotiation then, really. Well, I mean, if the other person—
not with that guy, but with the person and the speaker, they're listening to— so I'm making my points to— he's the receiver for the messages.
Yeah.
The decision makers are outside the room, but you've got to make those points because they're the ones that are ultimately reflected. It makes it extremely slow and tedious to negotiate.
And probably hard because you can't detect the facial, you know, what's going on in the mind of the person who you're actually talking to, because the person you're actually talking to isn't in the room.
Right. Although in time, I think those two, there's a bit of a mind meld where you begin to see in the face of the counterpart.
Right.
The reflection of what they're being screamed at
it's
about.
It's like there's a puppet with a mask and you have to interpret the mask to know what the puppeteer is.
Negotiating with North Korea is not easy.
What was the aircraft carrier thing that I muddled up?
We had the Singapore summit in June of 2018, and this is both the proclivity of the president of the United States, Donald Trump, but also the North Koreans. They just loved they all loved the fanfare and media attention, and the, you know, it was quite the moment. Singapore was just insane, and I wasn't there. I should say that I only started after Singapore because that's when the decision was made to have a negotiation. Up until then, it was a conversation about a negotiation. Secretary Pompeo and I flew to Pyongyang on my first visit as the special representative, as a chief negotiator, in October of 2018. And one of the issues that we wanted to test was another summit, because the hypothesis that we were testing here was that all the failed diplomacy of the preceding 25 years was because it left room for maneuver for the senior leader in North Korea to kind of pick and choose or say no or yes. But if you engaged him in the actual discussion at the leader level, then you were working the system in the right spot. Because like I said, you're negotiating with the system, but here you're working with absolutely the top of the system. And you would hope that whatever he decides gets driven down into the system and becomes their position. So the hypothesis here was leader level diplomacy could resolve the issues that 25 years of working groups and, you know, six party talks and et cetera had never been able to resolve in a durable way. And so one of the things we want to talk about when we were there in October 2018 is another summit meeting. We used those summits as action causing events. That was our strategy anyway. And North Koreans wanted another summit. So they were ready to talk about it. And it wasn't just North Koreans. It was actually Chairman Kim. So Secretary Pompeo and I are meeting with Chairman Kim, with his sister Kim Yo-jong, in an interpreter. And then we had our own in a closed door for about 2 or 3 hours in Pyongyang. And when we got to the issue of the summit, they were already at yes on having another meeting. The question was where. Timing was a question too, but ultimately the question was where. And so we tested a few different ideas. He wanted Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, but the White House had already told us in advance, under no circumstances are we going to Ulaanbaatar in February. And there's only one hotel there that's worth staying at. And you know, and so Chairman Kim put that on the table, and you know, Secretary Pompeo kind of pushed past and said, Well, what if we tried here? And we were looking at Thailand or Vietnam, and it was an interesting moment, Josh, because Pompeo listened to Kim Jong-un's suggestion, but they kind of moved on to the next possibility. He didn't really treat it seriously, and Kim Jong-un bristled. You could see it visibly. This is a guy who nobody says no to. This is a guy who's not used to having his idea kind of said, okay, well, a good idea, let's try something else.
Right.
When he says it, in his system, his idea is gospel.
Yeah. I just said Mongolia.
Yeah.
What do you not understand about that?
And so constraining his anger, but you could see him bristling, Kim Jong-un says, something along the lines of, I would appreciate if my idea was given consideration. And so we went back and we talked through the issues about Mongolia, you know, the winter, the weather, the press, the constrained hotel space. Kim Jong-un even volunteered to sleep on his train. So I'm going to take my train. I'll be on my train. President Trump can have the Shangri-La Hotel. And but the White House had already said, under no circumstances are we going to Ulaanbaatar. So we eventually moved on to testing other ideas. We proposed Bangkok. They weren't interested. We thought Bangkok would be a good location for both sides. I think we tested the DMZ as a possibility, but he said, perhaps I could meet you somewhere, for example, on a U.S. aircraft carrier. This was Kim Jong-un's suggestion. And we were like, oh my gosh, kind of liked the idea actually. But then there's no dock in South Korea or North Korea that we can bring a U.S. aircraft carrier to the shore. So it would have to be anchored off the coast, and he'd have to fly out on a U.S. helicopter. We wouldn't let someone else fly a helicopter onto one of our aircraft carriers. And logistically, it just, you know, it was interesting for a moment.
I mean, it's such a shame in a way, isn't it? Because it would have been, I think he doesn't understand what the optics would be of coming to a U.S. aircraft carrier. I mean,
there's a lot of history there.
There's a lot of history there. That is an act of humiliation. To my novice eyes, that would be an act of self-humiliation for the North Korean leader to come onto a U.S. aircraft carrier.
But he wasn't that way, interestingly.
He probably just thought it was cool. He didn't understand the context.
In the year 2020, Secretary Pompeo and I met the top two officials in the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Yang Jiechi, who was a state counselor, and Wang Yi, who Sui Chiang Kai, the then ambassador, and Zheng Zhaguang, that now a Chinese.
You could pretty much say any names, and I would believe.
Okay, trust me on this. in the absolute darkest moment of the COVID pandemic in June of 2020, we were doing one last meeting to try to arrest the sharp decline in the U.S.-China relationship, see if there was any basis for, you know, kind of finding the bottom. And so the Chinese and we agreed to meet in Hawaii, you know, kind of equidistant from Washington and Beijing. And the only place we could meet in all of Hawaii was on a U.S. military base because of the lockdowns, and Hawaii was particularly tough on its lockdowns, and the state governor has a lot of authority in the state. And so we could only meet on a federal facility there to bring the Chinese, because they refused to be COVID tested or anything like that. That was a non-starter for them. And so we said, okay, well, we're going to do it at Pearl Harbor. And they're like, under no circumstances will we come to Pearl Harbor. To your point,
you are seeking
to send messages.
Yeah,
and we're like, well, come on.
I'm with them on this. They did it, Stephen.
They did it. We had a great meeting. I should take that back. We had a meeting.
You had a meeting. I mean, speaking of meetings versus great meetings, the negotiations. You know, you say it wasn't a failed negotiation ultimately in Hanoi with the North Koreans, but it didn't reach an agreement. And prior to President Trump, as you were saying, like, there'd been 25 years of diplomacy. And when Trump started floating the idea of meeting Kim one-on-one, there was a lot of, I remember, you know, eyebrows being raised amongst the foreign policy establishment saying, like, you know, this guy's an idiot. He doesn't realize Trump meeting. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't understand that the top level meeting is supposed to happen after all the groundwork has taken place. There are professional career diplomats who've spent their lives studying this stuff and understand exactly what the contours of the North Korean regime are. And so the sort of, I suppose, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton worldview is you do all of that hard, wonky work in the background, and then that leads up to the leaders meeting. You don't just expect the leaders to meet and then come to some kind of agreement in the absence of all of that contextual stuff that the foreign policy establishment is supposed to do in advance. This isn't going to work. You didn't reach an agreement. Were they right in hindsight?
No. This is one of the things that really was attractive to me to take this position, is President Trump didn't have any time for that rubbish. And it is rubbish. That's what didn't work for 25 years.
But the other one didn't work either.
Right. Okay, fair enough. But we were trying something new. We were testing a new idea. It hasn't worked yet, I'll say. But it's not over. In Trump's mind, it's certainly not over. I'll tell you that, Josh. You can see it in his occasional comments. He's a little bit busy right now. So North Korea isn't occupying the top spot on his to-do list. But it's out there. This is a tendency in the United States that is somewhat frustrating at times, which is that, you know, we think we're punishing another country by not talking to them. So let me take the example of Russia. So for better part of a decade, well, 8 years from 2014 to 2022, we wouldn't talk to Putin. I don't love Putin, and I think people know well my views of the Russian government and the terrible things that it's done and are doing right now. But we thought we were punishing Putin by not talking to him. But what we were really doing is giving him more room for maneuver. We were not forcing him to confront challenges to his views or his potential actions. We were allowing him to surround himself with sycophants who were feeding him information that he wanted to hear. And in the process, we allowed him to stew on his own perverted sense of what the history of Ukraine is, and to convince himself that it wasn't a country and that he needed to conquer it and reabsorb it into Russia, and all the attendant issues came with that. But, you know, we kind of could smugly claim the moral high ground that we did not grace him with our presence. I think that's a mistake.
Do you think that he really went off the deep end on Ukraine because America didn't talk to him? I mean, he annexed Crimea in 2014, so he was already champion at the bit.
But we were already isolated. We were already withdrawing from engagement with him in 2014 too. So this even goes back further to 2008 with Georgia. The COVID had a big impact on this too, because he was really in the most extreme isolation. But really, just a case of you wonder what his mental health state was at a certain point.
I've wondered about this. If you were a betting man, if COVID doesn't happen, does Putin still invade Ukraine, or is he deranged by that? you know, isolation.
Counter histories are hard to make the case for. You just don't know is the short of it. But you know, President Trump says he wouldn't have invaded if President Trump was still the president, too. He said it never would happen on my watch.
Do you buy that?
At a certain level, maybe. Again, I think being in the other side's face is productive and good for you. It's not, I don't think it's a moral compromise to be in the other side's face.
So there's this view of the war in Ukraine, you know, that skeptics of American power put forward, which is that at the end of the Cold War, we were all triumphalist. I say we, meaning the Western world broadly, America and its allies, and didn't give Russia the respect that it deserved. We're too enthusiastic about expanding NATO. We're too victorious. Mm-hmm. And that was irksome to an old KGB hand like Putin and his cronies, and that from their perspective, they're in a defensive posture rather than an aggressive one. This is a kind of a Mearsheimer, you know, Walt view of American power. Do you have time for it?
Yeah, not at all. I think it's an invented narrative, and I think it's counterfactual. It's not proven by the events that took place. First of all, we were incredibly generous and forward-leaning and gracious after the collapse of the Soviet Union. President George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41, was adamant in his instruction across the government that nobody call this a victory. This is a shared victory between us and the Russian people. That they were as much victims of that history as the people that they committed offenses against, and that he would never allow that. We provided billions of dollars assistance, not sensibly, quite frankly, much of it wasted. We tolerated too much corruption and ultimately the deterioration of even the nascent democracy that was forming in Russia. But the U.S. approach towards Russia was incredibly generous. With NATO enlargement, we brought them into the discussion. It was discussed with them in the early waves of NATO enlargement. There was acquiescence. They didn't love it, but they also understood it. And if you look back now to that period from the 1990s forward, you know, it'll never happen. But Vladimir Putin owes NATO and the West a thank you, because what happened is stable, peaceful democracies began to be constructed along the borders of Russia that posed absolutely no threat to Russia. In fact, chaos, corruption, weak governance would have been a far more dangerous consequence of that period than these strong, stable, secure democracies Poland, like the Baltic states.
That assumes that Putin's worldview is as rational as yours, and that he doesn't code what we see as peaceful, stable democracies as proxies for a Western hegemony that is hell-bent on undermining the Russian dominance of that sphere.
So we have to be careful not to project our logic on others like Putin. So Putin would constantly...
But isn't that what we're doing by assuming that he has to see peaceful Western democracies
So Putin would, I'll come back to that, but Putin would constantly refer to Ukraine as a threat to Russia. There's no objective way that we would consider that Ukraine's a threat to Russia.
Right.
Ukraine is weak. Ukraine doesn't have a military. It's poorly armed. It's poorly governed. When we think about a threat, us in the West, say, we think about a threat in terms of, can a country invade my territory? What could that country undermine could it destroy my economy? Could it undermine my political system? That's a threat that we would conceive of threat. But that, for, you know, Putin's an authoritarian. Authoritarians have a very different view of what a threat is. What threatens them is what they don't control. So Putin doesn't see Ukraine as a threat like we would in a conventional way. He sees it as a threat because he doesn't control it and he needs to control it. And it goes beyond the borders of Ukraine too. He needs that control. That's the nature of authoritarianism, is what you don't control threatens you. That's why authoritarians, usually their biggest fear is their own people. I mean, the resources that China and Russia use to repress their own people dwarfs even what they spend on building up their militaries and adventurism abroad. And so for Putin, that's his threat. That's not a threat that we can accept, that he has to control. And this is part of the gift that Russia got in the 1990s when stable, secure, democracies and prosperous countries grew on their borders through NATO, through the European Union. All the wars in Europe, all the wars in Central Europe started when the strong invaded the weak. It's the, there's just some magnetic pull to the weak or disintegrating state that brings the outside powers in to seek conquest. And so this even, you know, the Russians will never agree with me on this. I'll just say that right out. But the Russians even were able to avoid the attraction of trying to once again annex and conquer Poland, for example, or the Baltic states. But Ukraine was kept outside that, partially because of its own decrepitude, its weak governance, its corruption, partially because, you know, I think in 2008 we made the judgment that it would be too provocative to bring Ukraine and then Georgia into the Western world. It would be too provocative for Moscow, and so we didn't do it at the 2008 NATO summit in Bucharest. And ironically, those are the two countries that Putin has invaded since.
I mean, they're also, I mean, the other thing about Ukraine, of course, is it looms very large in the Russian imagination in a way that Poland may not. I mean, it used to be the seat of Tsarist Russia, right? I mean, like, he has this...
I'm Polish American, Josh. My great-grandfather's immigration papers, he renounces his potentate, Nicholas II of Russia. And I'm Polish. I'm not Russian.
My grandmother was born in Poland as well. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that the Russians haven't meddled a lot, but there seems to be something uniquely, like, attractive. If he's Gollum, then Ukraine is his precious.
Yeah, like, so it's a long history, and there's, you know, And the you know, Kievan Rus in the year 1000 was the birthplace of what ultimately grew into become the Russian Empire. But Ukraine has always been a separate and distinct part of it. And this is what I talk about is that, you know, Putin's perverted version of history. He's constructed in his mind a historical narrative where this is like the heartland of Russia,
and
he's wrong, and the Ukrainian people are wrong, and it didn't matter even if he was right. Historically, this was a sovereign, independent nation recognized by Russia, the United Nations, by every country in the world recognized the sovereignty of Ukraine, and it wasn't his prerogative
to cross those borders, invade
the country, and try to incorporate it into Russia.
If you were Grand Emperor with a time machine of the universe and you were able to go back and try to prevent it from happening, do you take action when he invades Georgia? Do you take action when he annexes Crimea? Do you just wait until 2022 and then go all out and not hold back on what you're giving the Ukrainians and call his bluff and say, no, we're going to give them the long-range missiles that they need that you say you're going to blow up the world if we give them? What do you do?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of context in the moment. I'm not dodging the question. It's hard to answer, but let me answer it in a different way, and you can push me if you want me to answer more. There was a failure. There's only one person responsible for the invasion of Ukraine. That's Vladimir Putin. That one man started this war. That was not going to start without Vladimir Putin. But there are failures that we have to own as well. We'd given up on Ukraine because it was a corrupt and poorly governed country. We kind of stopped. We stopped engaging on Ukraine, and we should have known better than to leave this kind of gray zone, very unstable country in place and not expect across the entire lesson of history that somebody wasn't going to at some point move in. But more importantly, it was a failure deterrence. Now, a lot of that failure deterrence is on the part of the Ukrainians themselves for never having built a strong sovereign state that could rebuff Putin's invasion. But it was a failure of deterrence. We knew in December of 2021 that this invasion was going to happen. President Biden and his intelligence director spread the word far and wide that this is going to happen. Some of our allies didn't believe it until the eve of the invasion, but we knew it. We didn't do enough between the point at which we reached that conclusion and in February 24th of 2022 when he did the invasion to deter him. And we should have acted more. We should have armed the Ukrainians. We should have sent direct messages to Putin. Because
would you have met? I mean, would you have taken a leaf out of the Trump and Kim playbook and, you know, if you were President Biden, just got on a plane to Moscow and met with Putin if you could and said, listen, we know what you're doing. And if you do, then XYZ happens?
President Trump would have met with him. Absolutely. And so when President Trump says this war never would happen when I'm president, he would have certainly tried different things that President Biden didn't at that point, including meeting directly with Putin. You know, Trump is a real dilemma for the Russians. Because on the one hand, they really want to play him. They think that, you know, they think at one level, he offers a personality who's willing to give them a deal that they like. And another level, they also welcome some of the chaos and instability that he causes in the global system, and it causes even the United States of America with polarization, et cetera. You know, there's nothing not to like for them and all that. And yet he keeps handing them defeat after defeat after defeat, with a smile on his face and with a kindly word. And, you know, I like Vladimir Putin. He's a good guy, admiring him for being a killer. And yet their proxy in Syria is gone. Assad is gone. Their proxy in Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, is gone. Their proxy in Iran is under a sustained assault right now. He's a dilemma for the Russians, because on the one hand, he appears to be everything they'd want to be, but the outcome of that is exactly the opposite.
It's interesting that you raise this this contrast between the public and the private persona of the president, in the sense that this is something that I think a lot of Americans, a lot of people in the world are confused by and curious about. There's this public persona of somebody who appears superficially uninterested in policy details, prone to flights of fancy, prone to anger, unpredictable, humorless, and erratic, mm-hmm. right? And then you talk to some people who know him well, and they say, ah, that's an act. You know, he's actually quite thoughtful, he's quite funny, he's quite strategic, and he's taken big swings, and we'll see where they go. What was the who was the Trump that you worked for?
A little bit all that. I mean, there's nothing that is mutually exclusive in that entire set of descriptions that you gave. I mean, that is the complexity of Donald Trump.
Well, I think being humorless, thin-skinned, and stupid, by which I mean not book learned and stupid, but too overly focused on tactics without an understanding of strategy.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying there's any strategy here.
Well, I mean, those would be in conflict with a view of a person who's playing a character of a buffoon in order to play a strategic game with other people.
Yeah. We have already talked about this more than he's thought about it. Right. So one has to be very careful. He's impulsive. He goes with his gut. He's got the conceit of the negotiator, which is that everything is negotiable. I mean, at the root of his foreign policy is that notion that everything is negotiable. I actually don't think everything is negotiable. I think sometimes people don't want to give things up, and they're not going to. Kim Jong-un was not going to give up his nuclear weapons. The Iranians did not give up their nuclear weapons. Not everything is. Nicolas Maduro was offered an opportunity to live a cozy existence in a third country, but he didn't want to. He wanted to rule Venezuela.
He probably didn't buy it either. He probably didn't buy the threat.
I don't know. I mean, if he went to Moscow or something, Assad's there.
No. Not that he didn't buy that he would be safe, but I think he didn't buy that his rejection would lead to him being kidnapped in the middle of the night and then tried in a New York courthouse.
So how'd that work out? Yep, make the deal. This is who the president is, but that's not to call it strategic.
Right.
And it's very unpredictable. And so you can't predict what day you're getting what, you know, and also another feature, in this is both an opportunity and challenge to work inside the Trump administration as I experienced is, the president is incredibly transparent. He's the most transparent decision maker, that we've had in the presidency in my entire career in public service. But that's not always a good thing. Like, you know, the kind of the cliche is, you know, watching the sausage be made. The president tests ideas publicly. He relitigates them publicly. He seeks input, affirmation, or questions from various quarters, even people he doesn't like. He'll ask their opinion, and his decision making process is all in the public. It's full of feints and shifts and retreats and advances. It's peppered with rhetoric, insults, cajoling,
And is that true in the room as well?
A lot of it is public and performative, but he's still the same guy behind closed doors as he is in public.
What was he like as a boss?
you know, I don't want to exaggerate. I wasn't with him every day.
No.
I was with him episodically when I was North Korea negotiator. You know what? At the summit in Hanoi, when we got to the final moment of that agreement, I have to say I was impressed with the president. So he had laid out a proposal for Kim Jong-un. We had spent months developing this proposal that really required Kim Jong-un to say yes or no. Yes, I want to take this deal, which is going to transform history. It's going to be peace on the Korean Peninsula. It's going to be a permanent peace. You know, we still haven't signed a peace treaty in the Korean War. We're technically in a state of war, armistice. You know, maybe that was our one real achievement in Hanoi. Our main achievement in Hanoi was that we had a proposal that Kim Jong-un had to say yes or no to. And he said no. Now, before he said no, before it became a final no, president said, tested him. He said, look, can you give me a little bit more or can you ask a little bit less from us? And Kim Jong-un was like, no, can't do that. And the president said, well, you know, you haven't put everything on the table. We know there's parts of your nuclear weapons program that you're not willing to share with us here, but we know about it. And can we figure out a way to deal with that? And Kim Jong-un says, nope. And the president said, well, we tried. Gap's too large. Look, this has been great to see you. I love our meetings together. We got further along than we were when we last met, and we're going to keep trying. We'll get this done, but we're not going to get an agreement today. And so thanks for coming. Lovely to see you. Have a safe trip home and hope to see you soon. That's how it ended. It didn't end with acrimony or slamming doors or stomping out. Kim Jong-un looked like you could see the shock on his face that he just realized the moment it slipped away. He was convinced that the president desperately needed a deal. The president says, but the president understood that the contours of what they were offering was unacceptable to the United States, to our security, to our friends and allies and partners in the region, much less ourselves. And so the president said no. And that's what you want your president to do. So, we went into the hold room before that ultimate meeting. We had one more break, you know, where both sides went back to confer and then come back for a final discussion. And he went around the room to John Bolton, to Mike Pompeo, to our Asia advisor, Matt Pottinger, et cetera, me, the chief of staff, the others who are there. And he said, okay, I don't think this is a deal that we can take, but what do you guys think? So he actually asked everybody and everybody said the same thing. We agree. And they weren't blowing in the president's ear. We all knew that the North Koreans were falling short and they weren't going to budge. And so the president came back and said, look, so we're not going to get a deal. And that's how it ended.
You mentioned John Bolton, Mike Pompeo. There were a lot of people in the first Trump administration who many people regard as being sort of the adults in the room, you know, the people who would guide him in ways that were consistent with traditional understandings of American foreign policy. If I had come to you in 2019 and I said, okay, I've got a crystal ball here. You're currently working in the Trump administration. There's going to be a terrible pandemic next year. Trump's going to lose the election. There's going to be a Biden presidency, but he's going to try to run for a second term in the midst of a concealed cognitive decline, and he's going to lose, and Trump's going to come back. And in that administration, you're going to have Kash Patel running the FBI. You're going to have the guy who hosts the weekend morning show on Fox News as the Secretary of Defense, and he's going to call himself the Secretary of War. You're going to have the Democratic lawmaker, conspiracy theorist Tulsi Gabbard running the NSA. You know, I could go through the clown car here. You're going to have Pam Bondi as Attorney General. You're going to have Kristi Noem at DHS. You are one of the adults in the room. You're a traditional and businessman. What would your concerns have been?
If you asked me this in 2019, I just wouldn't have seen that future, honestly.
But I'm telling you, it's going to happen.
Right. I understand. I would have treated it with disbelief that, I would have expected, maybe, well, obviously wrongly, that it would look a lot like it did. in the preceding years. And it wasn't all easy. And, you know, the president is a very unconventional leader. There's no process is just, you know, falls off the table immediately. President makes his own decisions. Like when he was tweeting on North Korea, 90% of the time I saw it after he posted it on social media, and I just had to react to it as the chief negotiator. It wasn't like, you know, we had some deliberative process that suggested the president tweeted.
Sure. No, but all of that scaffolding of which you were a part was able to guide American policy in the midst of this figure who was quite unpredictable in his tweeting and so on.
Certainly by the end of the Trump presidency, in January of 2021, I would have told you, Josh, that it was going to be different than the first term. I would have predicted that it would be very different. Not the least being because the president had 4 years of experience. President was much more accustomed to the levers of power, much more comfortable in his judgments, much less likely to second guess himself or to listen to the contrary advice, even gently applied from the senior officials around him. And so, in that sense, I would have predicted it would be different. This lineup of characters, I and a lot of people in Washington would be asked in the run up to the president's inauguration in 2025, you know, who's going to be this, who's going to be that, and you know, there's only a couple that anybody could have guessed in a million years were going to be in those positions. You were just taking off. Rubio would have been a pretty good bet,
for
Secretary of State.
You'll notice I didn't mention him.
Yeah, but not a lot of the others. There was a real concerted attempt in the personnel process in 2025 to the gatekeepers who were running that process sought to weed out any sort of independent thinking. They wanted people who were completely aligned with the president who, you know, in 2017, when President Trump was assembling his first administration, the filter was, have you said anything bad about the president? Did you sign one of the letters attacking him? Or, you know, do you have a social media feed that's full of never Trumper rhetoric? You know, have you done anything to oppose the president? It was very different in 2025. It was like, do you have a confirmed record of supporting the president? And then it would extend to things like accepting the fact that the 2020 election was stolen. Where did you come down on that? Did you affirm that the president was properly aggrieved that his election was stolen in 2020 and he was illegitimately deprived of the presidency? So by 2025, they were looking for positive affirmation, endorsement of the president.
We're aware of the loyalty tests. I guess my interest is that as a negotiator, part of your expertise and your role is to think through contingencies and to identify possible future risks and avenues. Well, if we accept this deal, then what happens? And to kind of game things out, right? To identify potential vulnerabilities or liabilities, what are the vulnerabilities and liabilities that you would have known in advance could emerge from having President Trump in power, surrounded by people who were there because of loyalty tests instead of competence?
Obviously, a very different circumstance than when I decided to go into the government in 2018. But I'm motivated by equal portions of patriotic willingness to serve my country. And I thought it was very important to serve my country in 2018, especially on the issue of North Korea, considering how close we came to a war in 2017. A second part of that is a practicality that the American people vote for the presidents. I get to choose whether I work for the president, and I have a free will. But I'm also a senior, experienced Republican foreign policy hand, and I should take very seriously whether I can contribute to that. And the third was you need a healthy measure of optimism.
I'm not giving you a hard time for taking the job there.
But but you can do it. Is my point is, but you have to approach it with a practicality. You know, I don't get to pick who's the attorney general or the secretary of defense or secretary of war. I don't get to pick that. I get to vote. I get cast one vote 77 million people elected Donald Trump. And so
would you vote for him this time?
We never disclose who we
voted for. Would you vote for him again if there was an election held tomorrow?
No, it'd be unconstitutional. Let me finish.
Yeah.
You can work in that world. You can bring a discipline, a patriotism, a practicality. You know,
of course but the current people aren't. And so I'm just interested.
Some people are. I could name people who weren't doing that in 2018 as well. Even some of the people you mentioned who are in that government in 2018 had their own agendas or were advancing themselves, not the country.
Right. Let me put it this way then. Do you have any personal anxieties about the trajectory of the United States between now and the inauguration of the next president?
Short term, sure, it's a very difficult time in America. It's very polarized polity. It's we have political violence in America. I mean, these are very uncomfortable times for many Americans. It's a period of dramatic policy shifts and transformation, an unconventional president, to say the least. So, yeah, but I also have maybe it's this optimism. I have a long-term confidence that everything is going to be okay. I'm not here to tell people bedtime stories that, you know, sleep well tonight because this is all going to work out in the end. But I'm saying there's a chance. And there's a chance because the people who constructed this government from its very beginning 250 years ago anticipated moments just like this. Our institutions are designed to be durable, as they were in January.
As long as the institutions continue to function and Congress, I mean, you know, the founders had an expectation that the legislative branch would be a proactive check on the executive branch. At the moment, it's not functioning that way.
They positioned it to be a proactive check. But, you know, I was speaking at a program a few months ago, and there was a journalist, a friend of mine, very smart guy, but he was talking about how the institutions would have failed but for Vice President Pence refusing to dismiss the election, or but for Congress having vote to affirm the election or so on. And I caught him right there. He's not an American. I said, look, you're misunderstanding America. Our founding fathers didn't design our institutions to work because good people were in them. They actually, exactly the opposite. They designed our institutions to work on the assumption that all human beings are going to be weak, greedy, power hungry, corrupt, and the institutions are forced to compete in friction. And then we have a regular process, almost, you know, it oftentimes feels like too many elections to constantly reaffirm that with the public. We're going to have another one in this year. And, you know, we may be having a very different conversation about America after November of 2026 than we're having today, Josh. Mm. You could have Democrats controlling the House and the Senate. The American people still get a say in this. And if they like it, they'll affirm it. If they don't, they'll cast it aside. And it will happen. An individual leader can't stand in the way of that. Mm. I think the evidence suggests that in 2020.
I know you got to go, but just thinking about the future of foreign policy, some countries have lines in the sand, as you said. It's been a bit difficult to know what Iran's line in the sand has been. Mm-hmm. Like, are they, you know, was the Obama nuclear deal, for example, just him being led up the garden path by the Iranians because they were dedicated to having a nuke, or was it worth giving a shot in order to try to buy time until the regime collapses under the weight of its own contradictions? Who knows? But in light of the fact that the United States has taken military action against Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and Iran and Venezuela, and now he's talking about Cuba, has U.S. foreign policy made the only logical thing to do to be to get a nuke? Because he's not talking about North Korea.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the president, you know, this is a question is particularly acute in the case of Iran, obviously, because the others were not in pursuit of a nuclear weapon. Iran demonstrably was.
Iran can look at the, I mean, every rogue state can look at the others and go, well, there's a reason why North Korea isn't on that list.
President's in a dilemma here. So the president's laid out, you know, three primary objectives on this war. One is to permanently remove the ability of Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. Second is to end their develop an advanced ballistic missile program. And the third is to curtail their regional destabilization. President is making noises like he wants to find a way out of this war now. I think you can see that in the press today. He doesn't think he's losing, incidentally. He doesn't think he's losing the war, but he wants to wrap it up. His challenge is that if he wraps it up without having achieved any of those three objectives, particularly on the nuclear weapons, then we're going to be in no better position after this war than, well, we will be in a better position, and that there's been a huge degradation of Iranian capabilities, but still, they have
depends what happens to Iran, doesn't it? I mean, if Jihad is send up with the enriched uranium, then
or even a survival of a revolutionary regime 2.0. It's hard to argue that the lesson that you would want them to learn from this is that pursuit of a nuclear weapon made them more vulnerable to this kind of attack. But I think it's reasonable to believe that the lesson that they are going to draw from this is we should have had the nuclear weapon. And so now we're really in a dilemma here that I think it was Machiavelli who said, if you try to kill the king, be sure you do not miss. That's kind of where we are, that you can't half topple this regime. It's kind of a fight to the end now. And that's the dilemma the president finds, because I'm not sure the president is there. I think he's got very oftentimes very flexible view of what is a winning outcome, and he'll sell it as such. But the Israelis have a very different view of that. The Israelis believe that Iran poses an existential threat to Israel because of their combination of nuclear weapon and their hatred for Israel and their threat to annihilate Israel. It is a lesson in geopolitics, and incidentally, that if you tell someone often enough that you're going to annihilate their country, they may do something about it. And Israel's doing something about it too. I don't know that the president can get out of this conflict without addressing the three reasons why we got into this conflict. Otherwise, it does run the risk of being an even more dangerous situation in the long run.
Stephen, fabulous to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, great to see you.